I think other countries can demonstrate their commitment to the rule of law by very vocally showing that the International Criminal Court's indictment of this year must stand. Over 150 countries are members of the Rome Statute, and this resolution came about from the UN Security Council. So this is the request for the ICC investigation and indictment came from the body that monitors and enforces international peace and security. So other countries have, if not a legal responsibility, at least a moral one to support this indictment.
What do you make of this Arab League rejection of the indictment asking the UN Security Council to stop the court action?
It's extremely concerning. This is where Darfur, especially, where the victims are Muslims, are members of the Arab community, and so they should be especially active and vocal about ending this conflict. So it's frustrating to see the Arab League not being on the side of justice, but on the side of the perpetrator.
Since the March 4th indictment, the parties have turned this showdown into a classic game of championship chess. One party makes a move, the other turns up in Eritrea. The next move draws a response of travel to Egypt, then to Libya. Is this what we want to come out of the International Court indictment, or was it a misstep in tactics that's emboldening some countries to lobby to call off the indictment?
I think Bashir is an individual, and his government has made the decisions to expel the aid groups and to travel throughout the region in defiance of the indictment. The indictment itself didn't force him to expel these aid organizations or force him to go on a tour to try to recruit people to support him getting a deferral of the indictment or dropping the indictment completely. So I think the ICC had all the rights of investigating and have found evidence beyond a reasonable doubt that he committed war crimes and crimes against humanity.
But isn't this a failure of tactics if it's not working, if it's generating the wrong type of reaction that the world had hoped it would?
I don't think this is any different from when a domestic court, whether it's local or circuit or at the Supreme Court level, making a judgment and then having the states or the federal government enforce it. It's up to the member countries to make those decisions, not the International Criminal Court. So I don't fault the court for its tactics or strategies. That's what the rest of the member states who created and formed the International Criminal Court and helped it by giving it jurisdiction on its conflicts.
Is it legitimate to expect that countries who support President Bashir in summit resolutions, UN votes, or extending hospitality to him should face diplomatic consequences now for supporting him?
Yeah, I think this is something where we need to look at the details on the indictment and how it gets enforced with just the ICC or the UN Security Council. But I think other countries should, not just morally, but diplomatically or economically, understand that there are consequences to negotiating with a war criminal.
What kinds of pressures or constraints does the United Nations still face in having to deal with Sudan in order to maintain the integrity and operability of the hybrid international peacekeeping force that's still operating in Darfur?
The UN requires the consent of the host government, so in Sudan, and it requires Sudan's consent to operate inside of the country. The other agencies like UNICEF or World Food Program aren't invading the country Sudan, so they need the consent to function. So that's the limitations. As long as Sudan gives them permission, they're able to operate. When they don't, then they're significantly limited in the impacts they're able to have.
Well, last week, the special ambassador for Sudan from the UN and the African Union remarked that the arrest warrant had actually compromised the West's goals of solving the Darfur crisis. Do you think he was justified in taking that position?
You know, there's still speculation on what the impact is. The government is claiming to be more proactive in being able to substitute the international aid organizations that were expelled. But as more information is coming out, not just in Darfur, but South Sudan, the Blue Nile, Kordofan region, there's going to be a significant impact on the civilian population where death toll is going to skyrocket either because of malnutrition or public health disaster, malaria, diarrhea, or other diseases because the aid agency has now been expelled. So I think this is just a snapshot on what the UN in its assessment made, and we'll see that change if the other aid agencies are allowed back in.
Is there still hope that they can stay?
I think there's hope that they can get back in. You know, with U.S. leadership, we spearheaded a peace agreement between the north and south of Sudan with, at that time, Ambassador Jack Danforth. Without deploying any U.S. force or there wasn't a significant international force, we brought a peace agreement between the north and the south. All we're saying is we need to have that same peace surge in Darfur where we make this a priority for our foreign policy and get those aid agencies back in and then bring about peace to this conflict.
Do you see any possibilities that the new leadership in the United States would consider the military option at this point? There had been talk during the campaign by certain players in the campaign that they were advocating some sort of a force to put more pressure on Sudan's president to resolve the crisis.
Yeah, I think when it comes to genocide and mass atrocities, all options should be kept on the table. So military options should be on the table and should be considered. However, I think they should be used as a last resort because we've been able to see a lot of traction using diplomacy and economic pressure. So if it gets to that point where military options should be considered, then we are supportive of those options.
Is there a trade-off at risk right now? You spoke of the comprehensive peace agreement for southern Sudan that was forged several years ago. That's up for a period of renewal coming up. Do you see that there might have to be a trade-off in order to get a solution for the Darfur crisis?
I don't think there has to be a trade-off. The U.S. is the most powerful country in the world. We can walk and chew gum at the same time. We should be able to help our economic crisis get improved situations in Iraq, Afghanistan, and have an all-Sudan solution. We shouldn't have to split different policies in Sudan with a trade-off. We can do this both. It's with the same repressive government that we need to negotiate and bring about a solution to all of Sudan, not just the north or just Darfur.
And recently there was a story about some weapons going through Sudan to the conflict in the Middle East in the Gaza Strip area. Do you see the Sudanese reaction to this as complicating a solution to Darfur?
Yeah, I think that information still needs to be verified, at least from our end. Certainly including involvement in other conflicts or other issues certainly does complicate things, but the eyes on the prize should be kept on protecting innocent civilians. So while the different actors or different rebel groups or meddling in other conflicts tends to happen, whether proxy or directly, the U.S. government should maintain a coherent foreign policy in ensuring that this genocide is brought to an end, regardless of or inclusive of all the actors needed to bring about that peace agreement.
Do you think that the reports that came out last week about the recent bombings in Sudan may have generated some resistance among Arab League delegates meeting this week that could promote even more resistance to Western demands to enforce the arrest warrant on President Bashir?
Sure, I can imagine there'd be some resistance, but we need to find out what exactly happened and address it, and then come back to the original situation of bringing peace to all of Sudan. So while this might be a distraction or substantive issue that needs to be dealt with, it comes back to bringing an end to all the conflicts in Sudan.
The Genocide Intervention Network has had great success in the United States mobilizing citizens to phone a genocide hotline at 1-800-GENOCIDE to bring their views to the attention of Congress and energize lawmakers here in the U.S. to speak out on the tragedy in Darfur. How has this process fared since the March 4th indictment?
This process has galvanized American public support for ending the conflict in Darfur, both through diplomatic means and ensuring justice, ending the culture of impunity. So we're seeing more people call 1-800-GENOCIDE to get more involved in ensuring that the U.S. is on the right side of this and pulling the rest of the international community to support it.
And what's been the reaction from U.S. politicians so far?
U.S. policymakers such as Ambassador Susan Rice have been very supportive of the indictment. Also, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has been very vocal about supporting the indictment and holding President Bashir accountable for every death that happens on his watch.
Well, President Obama, Vice President Biden, Senators Clinton and McCain and many other American politicians showed a strong commitment to the anti-genocide movement during the political campaign. Now that it's ended, what do you see as being most important for the president and others to do to overcome a slowing down in the diplomatic community of taking urgent action?
Well, the genocide movement is continuing. It hasn't ended. Their political campaign, now that they're in positions of power to govern, has ended. But this is the moment where they can translate a lot of their campaign promises into policy. And one of those great steps was to create a special envoy for Sudan with Scott Grayson. And so this is the step where we've got the right people in place, and now we need to see them enforce their campaign promises to end this genocide.
Tell us a little more about the work of your intervention network and what it has been doing lately to step up the pressure.
Sure. Well, the Genocide Intervention Network's mission is to empower individuals and communities with the tools to prevent and stop genocide. And in doing so, we're creating the first permanent anti-genocide constituency. And we provide tools to allow any American to not be a bystander to genocide, but be an upstander. So we've created a hotline called 1-800-GENOCIDE for anyone to call their public official from the House to the Senate to the White House and demand that they do more and just talk about it. And so that's it's like the 911 of stopping genocide. The second tool is protection, where we raise money to protect people directly on the ground. And people can text the word protect on their cell phones to 90999, and $5 will be added to their cell phone bill so people can directly put money where their mouth is and protect people on the ground. And we're conducting firewood patrols in Darfur right now.
Now, do these phone numbers, the 1-800-GENOCIDE and the text messaging, hold true for people who live outside the United States? Our audience is all around the world. Would they benefit also from dialing these numbers and expressing their views on genocide?
Well, we are expanding some of these tools. So in Canada, 1-800-GENOCIDE works. But we do have partners throughout the country where they can find either using that specific number or whatever is appropriate for their country or city.
And what, for instance, would that be for somebody living outside the United States? Can you pick a country and just tell us how somebody might respond in those countries?
Well, the best way that people from other countries like the UK or Australia are able to get involved is going onto our website, www.genocideintervention.net, and there you can see what public officials are doing either in their country or in the U.S., and also donate to our protection fund, which will take funds from anyone from any part of the world to directly protect people on the ground.
Now, among your constituency here in the United States, there have been great expectations because President Obama, as the first African-American president, showing his strong support on the issue of Darfur and speaking out against genocide, has generated a lot of excitement. Do you find that the constituency among African-Americans has gone way up because of this also?
I'd say from the very beginning, the involvement of the African-American community and many others, the Jewish community, Muslim community, have all been involved. So you're seeing people recognize that genocide is not just a Jewish or African issue or any specific demographic. This is a crime against humanity. So we haven't seen any big change. We've been involved from the very beginning. The Congressional Black Caucus to the NAACP have been involved and continue to be involved. So we're hopeful that regardless of who is president or who is in Congress, every American should care about stopping genocide.